Hello there, and welcome to the Authentic Recruiter Podcast. I'm your host, Claire Ackers. This podcast is all about what it really takes to grow a profitable and purpose-led recruitment company. In this space, you can expect to be inspired, you can expect to be empowered, and you can expect to be equipped with everything you need to achieve the recruitment business of your dreams. Thanks for tuning in. I'm so glad you're here, and let's jump in to the episode. Today, I am very excited to be sitting down with Jo Major. Jo, I will let you get straight into it. Tell us a little bit about who you are and how you got to be where you are today, if that's okay.
Yeah, that's fine. Thanks for having me, first of all, Claire. Much appreciated. Very excited to be here. My name's Jo Major, and I founded Diversity in Recruitment just over a year ago. What do I do? Now I basically train and advise recruiters, both agency side and in-house, on how to make what they do from a recruitment perspective more inclusive, more accessible, and more equitable, and help them to attract underrepresented talent and partner with their clients more effectively and I guess more confidently when it comes to supporting equality, diversity, and inclusion efforts. And a lot of the work that I do with recruiters is to really give them that confidence through education and learning, and help them to get to grips with the basics of everything equality, diversity, and inclusion, and recruitment. How have I come to get into this position, to have the credentials, I guess, to do this work? That's through my background in recruitment. So I've been in the recruitment industry now for coming up to 22 years. It sounds like an awful long time. But I spent 17 and a half of those years actually on desk as a billing recruiter, billing manager.
What was your sector?
So I started off in industrial recruitment. So before the days of automation, recruiting contract staff into roles in factories and industry, basically. And then I moved into education and spent quite a long time working with brilliant teachers and support staff and primary and secondary schools, both in the north of England and London as well. And then I moved into the not-for-profit sector. So had the absolute privilege of working with charities of all different shapes and sizes, and recruiting a whole range of specialist experts into that sector. Anything from kind of comms and marketing people to the income generators of charities, right up to kind of C-suite, chief execs, HR directors. So really broad.
Fantastic. So this is one of my favorite questions to ask people on the podcast, is about the niggle, the entrepreneurial niggle. You know, what was it that made you think, you know what, I'm going to take this experience in recruitment and I'm going to use it to create my own business?
I like that. What was my niggle? I think it was, so I spent a little bit of time working for APSCO over lockdown, and that gave me a really unique opportunity to kind of look over the recruitment industry, which is something that I'd never done before. I'd always been kind of very internal focused or sector focused externally, depending on what area I was recruiting into. And I was doing quite a bit of work with them to get them started on their own journey, and also to develop their member services, the D&I member services. And I just realized that there wasn't much out there in terms of support for the recruitment industry when it came to diversity and inclusion. There was a lot that was going on from a training, advisory, and consultancy level when it came to end clients, but there wasn't so much support that was available for recruiters on desk. And so that's where I guess I spotted an opportunity to blend my recruitment experience, my L&D experience, and my D&I knowledge, and produce a training program that would be suitable for recruiters. there is absolutely no point in doing all the work client end if your talent pipeline are not also focusing on diversity and inclusion. And so that was kind of like my real niggle, that why was nobody doing this? I had to do something. That makes sense.
It makes absolute sense. And I was so pleased that our paths crossed, and they've only crossed quite recently, haven't you? We've only just come into each other's worlds. And I'm so glad that we have done, because the work you are doing is so, so needed. And there's such an opportunity to influence people's careers by working right with the recruiters. I could be getting this completely wrong, and please tell me if I am. Because I do a lot of work with people who work, I have a lot of friends in D&I consultancies, that kind of thing. Mm. And there's a lot of work going on at the kind of the end client, as it were. Mm. And some of the criticisms I hear is that it is hard for the recruiters to focus on being more diverse and inclusive because they have such commercial pressure. Is that something that you find?
I think that the metrics that we work against in the recruitment industry don't facilitate an inclusive recruitment environment.
Yeah,
absolutely. I think it's a real, real challenge for the industry. I'm not saying it's impossible. We've definitely got the kind of like capability, but I think we need to look at how we measure our recruiters, how we measure success, the metrics that we apply to them, and the actual processes that we're going through. If you look at like the methodology around inclusive and accessible and equitable recruitment, it very much mirrors the retained model. Mm-hmm. So all those kind of like that multi-layered approach that you take to retain searches, the way that you assess talent, the time that you have to go beyond your, you know, immediate networks. A lot of the methodology is already existing. It's just creating an environment for recruiters to be able to work within that space and work within those parameters.
Yes.
A lot of the time, you know, our focus is getting candidates across to clients in the quickest amount of time, right?
There's the whole race to the bottom philosophy.
Yeah, there's always been, you know, I used to, when I was a recruitment trainer, and part of my sales training was, you know, remember that time kills deals. Mm. And now I train people to slow things down, because actually speed kills inclusion. And so is it possible for every single type of recruiter to apply an inclusive recruitment methodology in our current environment? I would argue absolutely not. You've got to make a decision, I think, as a recruiter, when a client says to you, our focus is on underrepresented talent. Mm-hmm. And as a recruiter, it's then your responsibility to talk about either a retained proposition for inclusion, or as an alternative, an exclusive relationship. Any client that requires CVs in a 24-hour turnaround or 1 week turnaround isn't prioritizing inclusion and accessibility and equity in their hiring. But often we haven't got the knowledge or the skill set to be able to navigate that conversation, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So is it about education first and foremost?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, as recruiters, as an industry, we've got an immense amount of pressure to fix a problem we've got no understanding of. You can't fix a problem. You can't find solutions to a problem that you don't understand, right?
Oh, no, that's interesting, Jo, because that is actually one of the biggest pillars, shall we say, of the recruitment industry. I'm sure you've been in there. When you think back to when you were a rookie and you had a brand new client and they said, I need you to go find me an XYZ. We are bullshit merchants, right? Do you know, a client says to you, can you go and find me one of these? You say, yes, absolutely, no problem. Put the phone down, Google, Google, Google. What the hell is that?
Can I just say, I didn't have Google when I first started recruitment.
All right, get the yellow pages out, right?
I know what you mean.
Yeah, so we're laughing about it, but I think is that the first step, then, actually getting recruiters to go, you know what, I don't know enough about this topic. Tell me what I don't know.
Yeah, I think that, you know, it is that one area that you cannot, you can't blag your way through a conversation around D&I if you don't know the basics. And I often say, you know, to people who lead recruitment businesses, you would never allow a recruiter to go into a meeting with a client to talk about a multiple hire project or a retained proposition, or even if it was a new business meeting, mm-hmm. Without the relevant sector experience or specialism expertise. You know, in recruiter training, we're always kind of applying these labels as expert, right? It's so important for recruiters to be an expert in the world in which they, you know, operate within. So why are we expecting them to go into conversations with clients to talk around diversity and inclusion and inclusive hiring and equitable hiring and accessible hiring without giving them any training?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, but what's happening is we're saying yes to everything because we want to please our client. We might be going away afterwards and like, what does this mean for us? And then we're doing all the heavy lifting. Mm-hmm. And what we need to be doing is there's a lot of qualification that goes into taking a job brief from a client when it comes to underrepresented talent. You know, I'm seeing a lot of clients applying quotas, applying percentages to different types of identity, people that they want to see on the shortlist. And sometimes financially incentivizing recruiters to go and headhunt that group and that group. All of this stuff really goes against the whole grain of the Equality Act, right? What our clients are asking us to do is to choose one group over another, which is not what equality and diversity and inclusion is all about. But without that knowledge, how can we push back on that? How can we talk to our clients about an alternative approach to positive action rather than positive discrimination? So it's all part of that kind of like that diagnosis piece that we would as a recruiter usually go through. It's just adding an extra layer, seeing it through, you know, a D&I lens. And it sounds like super complicated, but it actually isn't once you unpick your traditional recruitment methodology and rebuild it and apply the accessibility and the equity and the inclusive part. That makes sense.
Hey, it's Claire here, just jumping on to check whether you have taken my recruitment impact and income scorecard. It's a short quiz, just 30 questions, and at the end, you will get your score and your personalized report. So if you're looking to grow a profitable and purpose-led company, what are you waiting for? Take the scorecard totally free of charge. There is a link in the show notes. Let's get back to the episode. Say there is a recruitment business owner or an independent recruiter who's perhaps looking to grow or wants to get things right for themselves. What would your top tips be to them for getting started on this D&I journey? And it is a journey, isn't it? It's never going to be done and dusted.
It is an absolute journey. Really important that you mention that, because it's not like you can just do a bit of work with me over a couple of months and then you're like, great, job's done, let's
box ticked on to the next thing.
It's literally just making a start. And even as somebody who's been reading and watching and listening and educating myself for the last kind of 4 or 5 years on this, I never use the word expert when I talk about the work that I do, because I think none of us can be an expert in everything, and we certainly have a limited lens of our lived experience as well that we can apply to our work. But in terms of like going on the journey, I think first things would be to see the importance of education, see the importance of training and investment, mm-hmm. and really look at how you can bring in somebody externally and use the people that you've got within your own organization. So for example, your L&D team. I do quite a lot of work, Claire, with L&D teams to train them up on all the stuff that I talk about so they can embed it into their sales, their recruiter sales training. So that's kind of like an ongoing piece that they will always have access, you know, access to. So I think from a, yeah, definitely from an access, from a training and education perspective, that would be number one. My second piece of advice would be understand how to partner with your clients on this. So don't take responsibility for solving inequality on your own. Make sure that you are partnering with clients who are sharing the load and also mirroring the changes that you might make to your processes. So they're not unpicking the work that you're doing. So approaching it as a partnership with clients, not carrying their burden and carrying their load. I think also another really important thing for me is to make sure that recruiters understand why we're doing this. Yes, there's, you know, we could talk about the business benefits for hours and hours. We could talk about it from a commercial perspective as a recruitment business, what it means to be more informed and to be able to be a credible, reliable partner to our clients. But let's not forget who we're actually doing the work for, which is underrepresented candidates. Those who are unable to or have a challenge getting work, getting a promotion, getting the salary that they deserve because of their identity, because of their background and because of their circumstances. And to really, really understand and accept and appreciate what inequality looks like in 2022 in the UK workplace and really stand in the shoes of the people that you're trying to attract. I think that gives you your, it centers your work. It gives you your kind of like North Star. And it makes you really understand what your mission is. That your mission, you know, for example, my mission is to make sure that somebody's identity is never the reason they don't get a job, a promotion, or the pay that they deserve. And actually, when, you know, we talk a lot, don't we, about centering our work around our candidates, then supporting our clients, and then looking at the benefits that that brings to us. And I think, you know, any work around ED&I should be always centered around candidates that are underrepresented. So we humanize what we do and we don't lose sight of it. Does that make sense?
It makes total sense. It's sort of a humanity first policy.
Yeah, it's got to be, not, but not from a saviorism perspective, because I see a lot of saviorism and it really irritates me.
Well, that's kind of patronizing though.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's not, we don't need to save anybody here, right? We just need to make sure that somebody's identity, background, and circumstances isn't a reason why they can't apply for a role within our organization or our clients' businesses.
Yeah. Yeah, of course. So that's, there's kind of two sides to this, isn't there? There's how we work with our clients and our candidates to improve opportunities. But then there's also the recruitment industry as a whole. And we had a little chat about this in our pre-show chat, didn't we, about representation within recruiters. And it's not great, is it? for an industry that calls itself meritocratic, it's not great. What are your thoughts on that and what can we do about it?
Yeah, it's a massive topic, isn't it? Sometimes I put myself in the firing line for my opinions on it. But I think there is a degree of us burying our head in the sand a little bit on this, and this absolute belief system that I think stops us from seeing the reality is that anybody can come and work in our industry. There are no barriers to entry. Everybody's welcome, which actually on paper is the truth. However, you look in our industry and you look at how easy it is to get into it, you would expect representation from every group that you can think of. And yet the demographics seem to be very, very similar. The frustrating thing is there's no data on the demographics, right? We know that the likes of APSCO and the REC have tried to go out there and collect that data, but we didn't manage to achieve that.
Okay.
You could argue that we didn't manage to achieve that because perhaps it wasn't prioritized as, you know, as a much needed data collection survey. I won't go into the details as to why we potentially got that book, but there isn't any data to back up what I'm saying here.
So we're speaking anecdotally. Let's make that clear to listeners.
And I guess I'm reflecting on kind of I've worked in the industry for 20 odd years. I still go to industry events where I will be one of a handful of females in the room. And I still go to recruitment events where there at times can be no people of colour in the room.
Right.
So I guess if you look at gender and obviously race and ethnicity, because you can see it, right? You can not always see it, but you tend to be able to see it more than other identity markers. But I've yet to work with a recruitment team where there are people with visible differences, where there are people with a visible disability, where there are people open about their disability, where there are people open about being neurodivergent, where there are people who are openly and comfortably non-binary or transgender, and the list goes on. And I'm being more reflective recently around age. And actually, do I believe that we as an industry represent the communities that we serve from a candidate and client perspective? Absolutely, absolutely not. It is not, it's very typical for me to look at a recruitment business, visit their website and see what looks like all white, all male, under 30, entire recruitment teams.
Still all in suits as well. Those awful branded photos, we're all walking together.
I'm seeing a little bit more flex in that. I'm seeing people's personalities a little bit more when it comes to the Meet the Team page. But I still see the cuffs and collars.
Yes.
And the next catalogue poses. And it often frustrates me. I'm like, gosh, what is under the surface? What are people, how can people show up to work? But, there's a reason why, isn't there? There's a reason why we don't represent the communities we serve. And I think we need to be really honest with ourselves in terms of why do we tend to recruit people that are very, very similar? Why have we almost built a stereotype for our own industry on what works and what doesn't? Why do we continue to see women get to a certain point in their career and then not reappear on the senior leadership team or board?
Yes, I'm being quite careful about what I say here because I don't want to land anybody in hot water, but only speaking from my own experience. Attitudes when I first got pregnant were not encouraging. I've got three kids and I ended up setting up my first company, my technology recruitment business, when I was on maternity leave with my middle child, so 2015, because there was just no flexibility on offer. And because I no longer fit the required hours or availability, it was just never going to work. And even before that, in my first recruitment job, the pressure to fit into the boys' club was, of course, it wasn't written down, but it was very much understood that if I didn't fit the mold and behave in a certain way and work certain hours and follow certain codes of behavior, then I was never going to get ahead and be successful. And from conversations I'm having with people, recruitment business owners now, we kind of hope that the pandemic would shift things, but it doesn't seem so. It seems like the recruitment industry is one of the biggest old bastions of you must be in the office to work these hours. We don't trust you to work from home. And of course, that's going to have a knock-on effect to employing people who have different requirements for lots of different reasons.
Yeah, we've got this, everybody's welcome as long as they can do this. And the parameters that we're setting ourselves for doing this job are very, very tight, which means that actually everybody's welcome, but not everybody can do this job in this way. And I guess, The pandemic has been transformational for a lot of recruitment businesses, but it's also, we've seen organizations go back to pre kind of pandemic practices.
Yeah, it's like, thank God that's over, right? Everyone back to the office.
yeah, absolutely. But there are, you know, we've got to acknowledge that there are organizations who have learned stacks and almost held a mirror up to themselves and have seen how the way that they were operating and the way that they were set up and the way that, you know, the environment that they insisted everybody work within had an impact on who was joining their business and who was leaving their business.
Mm-hmm.
And they learned from that, and they haven't carried, you know, into this kind of, you know, post-pandemic world that we're all operating within now. They've not carried that hangover into this period of time.
Have you got any positive stories you can share of companies that are getting it right? Obviously, yeah, you don't need to name names.
Yeah, but interestingly, I went to meet, I caught up with an organization that I know pretty well last week, and I was a bit of a, you know, if I'm totally honest and I was transparent with them, I was a bit, I wasn't sure what I was, you know, what I was going to, I'd been told that, you know, we've changed, we've evolved, we've moved forward. And I was thinking, hey, I'm going to need convincing. But actually spending some time with the organization, seeing an absolute transformation in culture and attitude. Well, that must be happening to support this new way of working. So instead of 5 days in the office culture, it's now 2 days in the office and that's flexible. 3 days working from home, a complete shift in tech stack to encourage accessibility and equity for everybody, which was, they really had torn up the one size fits all approach that they were, you know, that they'd stuck to for so many years, even right down to, like, you know, onboarding and training and just this new lens that they see things through now, where they appreciate that actually a one size fits all isn't going to work for everybody and in itself is exclusionary for some. And, you know, they're still very much on a journey, but it started almost like a ripple effect for them to start looking at, you know, just beyond the physical location and the technology, actually from an inclusion perspective, what else do we need to be doing? And I think candidates are going to be in a much stronger position to actually talk to them about what they need upon joining that recruitment business. Whereas before it was like, this is how you need to conform, this is how you need to fit in, this is the way that we do things, and this is the way that you need to adapt to us, mm-hmm. instead of talk to us about the working environment that gets the best out of you. What can we do to make sure that you thrive and you're successful and you stay with us? So yeah, that was really positive. And that's just like one example. I mean, I'm fortunate because a lot of the recruitment businesses that choose to partner with me on my training program, they're really progressive, they're really forward thinking, they're already on their journey. They're not taking me on to convince them that they need to be on their journey, because that's not my job. If I ever meet a client and there's a level of convincing, I'm like, nah, you need to do that first. And so they're already, you know, they're already looking at shifting the working environment, looking at their policies, looking at their processes, reinventing what like family building benefits look like, re-looking at hours and holidays and all of that kind of great stuff, looking at how do they need to respond to people who are neurodiverse? How do they need to create new environments for recruiters that are coming on board? So even some of the business, one particular business, they go beyond that traditional sales floor environment, you know, mm-hmm. where the only way to thrive and be successful is to be surrounded by the hype and the noise and the energy, recognizing that that doesn't work for 20% of the population.
Yes.
And actually enabling people to choose their workspaces and move around the office and have quiet space and recruit in a way that really works for them, which I think's a real step forward, rather than getting them to fit into this really usually heavily prescribed way of recruiting. Does that make sense, Claire?
It makes absolute sense. Yeah. And I'm just wondering if this is the next phase in the evolution of the recruitment industry. It's, and this is kind of where your work meets my work, because it's all about that psychological safety to bring your whole self to work. Yeah. And if companies, if anybody who's listening to this, who's getting excited about the conversation that we're having, this is the work, isn't it? It's creating that psychological safe place for employees to bring their whole selves. You know, my work's all about authenticity, knowing who you are and what you stand for and having the courage to live that every day. Yeah. If employers can create that environment where someone can say, actually, I need to be in a pod today and have nobody talk to me and get my head down, and that's okay. The vulnerability and the bravery, I guess, the courage that people could bring to their work when they can be that themselves.
Yeah.
That's got to improve how we recruit.
Absolutely. Because then we start to have different people in the room, Claire, right? We then become more representative of the communities that we serve. We then get, we're in a position to be able to tell our stories so that candidates and clients can find affinity with us, that can listen to our own journeys and build, you know, that psychological safety. And I think that there is a lot of talk, there's a lot of, you know, words on walls, there's a lot of, like, you know, these are our values, everybody's welcome, but actually there's a lot of work that needs to be done to say, to actually live that statement, everybody's welcome. Saying it isn't enough. It really, really isn't. That's just kind of like a mindset. It's actually behaviors and ethics that create inclusion, not just, you know, saying it. I've seen people go into organizations where it's been, you know, everybody's welcome as long as you can deal with the office banter, as long as you don't take offense to some of the, you know, to the jerks that we have, as long as you're
comfortable. You don't need a lift.
Yeah, as long as you can access our building, like, you know, like an able-bodied person can, as long as you can work off our database, as long as you can use all our tech in the way that it's been set up for, because we can't make any adaptations, as long as you're comfortable with all our events and all our socials revolving around alcohol, you know, and the kind of list goes on. And I think to have a truly inclusive environment, you need to understand what inclusion means for individuals, and you can't necessarily get that information through the recruitment process. That really takes time, to be able to build that trust with somebody that you're onboarding. If you do the work, you may get a level of that before somebody comes on board. But I think for me, that really vital part is when you're onboarding somebody. And there's one thing that I would encourage hiring managers, recruitment business owners to do, is to make sure that a really authentic conversation around inclusion is had with everybody that you're bringing into your business. And this is not to be done by your D&I person or your HR person. This is the person that they're reporting into. Mm-hmm. So making sure that line managers have got the skills to be able to have this conversation around, okay, so you're joining the business, it's your first week. I need you to be really open with me around what I need to do and what we need to provide you with so you can bring your true self to work every day, whether that be psychological, whether that be physical, whether that be to meet the needs of your faith, whether that to be to support the fact that you're neurodivergent and you need adaptations made to your technology, whether that be flexible working to accommodate your school runs, whether that be the fact that you're planning on having, you know, a child through surrogacy or fertility in a year's time. I think for me that and that's not something we do. And what we see as a result is people will cover, people will hide, people will wait until they've passed the probation to really talk to us about what they really need. And by the time, I mean, for me, that's too late. You know, I would want to know all of that stuff before somebody, you know, passes the probation, because being able to show up as their true selves is more likely to get them over that probation line and get them performing and get them onboarded quicker.
Of course. Of course. Oh my gosh, Jo, I could just talk to you all day, and thank you. It's been absolutely amazing to speak to you. I'm going to put some links in the show notes about how people can find you if they've been excited by this conversation and want to continue it with you. But yeah, just thank you. It's been absolutely inspirational.
Thank you. I really appreciate you giving me a platform to talk about this stuff. I know it's not for everybody's choice for a podcast and recruitment, but it's a real pleasure and a total honor to be able to be invited and talk about something I'm really passionate about.
That is it for today. Thank you so much for being here, and I hope you enjoyed the episode. Please don't forget to like, rate, and subscribe so you never miss an episode. And if we're not already, let's connect on LinkedIn. See you next time.